Welcome to the African American Hour. I'm Byron Buckner, bringing you an hour of news, history, commentary, and information about the African American community. This week, I'll have readings from the Associated Press, an opinion piece from the Washington Post newspaper. I'll be ending today's program with an article about the Smithsonian Museum from the New York Times. And I'm starting with this selection from Smithsonian Magazine. The title is, The Only Black All-Female Unit to Serve Overseas During World War II Receives the Congressional Gold Medal. This was written by Ellen Wexler and published April 30th, 2025. The subtitle to the story is, The 6AAA cleared a years-long backlog of mail in just 3 months. 80 years later, the unit is finally getting the recognition it deserves. When Congress voted to bestow its highest honor on the 6AAA Central Postal Directory Battalion in 2022, only 6 members of the 855-person World War II unit were still alive. Due to logistical delays, the Congressional Gold Medal ceremony wouldn't be held for another 3 years. By the time it finally took place on April 29, 2025, 4 of the 6 surviving members of the unit had died. The 6AAA was the only black all-female unit to serve overseas in World War II. It was tasked with sorting through a staggering backlog of mail. Millions of letters and packages that had been collecting dust for more than 2 years. So many other units had tried and failed to clear the backlog, Colonel Edna Cummings, who has pushed for formal recognition of the battalion, told Smithsonian Magazine's Chris Klimek in 2023. The Army thought it would take at least 6 months, if at all, to clear the backlog. 6AAA got it done in 3 months. They cut the processing time by 50%. On Tuesday afternoon, April 29th, House Speaker Mike Johnson presented the medal to the family of Charity Adams Early, the battalion's commanding officer. According to the Associated Press's Fernanda Figueroa and Matt Brown, more than 300 descendants of women who served in the unit attended the ceremony at the United States Capitol. Quoting an obituary published by the Niagara Gazette in 2021, Wisconsin Representative Gwen Moore, who sponsored the legislation, told the audience gathered at the Capitol that the unit's work was more than sorting mail. It was ministering to the souls of soldiers, making sure they received that little piece of home that reminded them that they were not forgotten. But for many years, history forgot about the 6AAA. The unit received no welcoming ceremony when it returned to the United States in early 1946. Despite its overwhelming success, it became a footnote in the history books. In recent years, however, the 6AAA has started getting the recognition it deserves. The unit received a meritorious unit commendation from the U.S. Armed Forces in 2019. A documentary was released that same year. Smithsonian highlighted the 6AAA's contributions in its March 2023 issue, and a Netflix film written and directed by Tyler Perry followed in 2024. As word spread, advocates began pushing for Congress to recognize the 6AAA. In 2021 and 2022, legislation to honor the unit with the Congressional Gold Medal passed unanimously in the United States Senate and House. Former President Joe Biden signed the bill on March 14, 2022. The process of designing and manufacturing the medal is time-intensive, but once these steps were finished, the ceremony faced continued delays. In January, a group of 16 senators wrote a letter to Johnson asking him to perform the ceremony. Those still surviving ought to not wait any longer to receive this long-awaited recognition they rightfully deserve, the senators wrote. The design and production of the 6AAA Congressional Gold Medal is complete. Therefore, we ask that you swiftly schedule a ceremony to recognize the service these women gave to our nation. However, ahead of the event, supporters had even more reasons to grow antsy about the lack of recognition, writes National Public Radio's Rachel Treisman. In January, as part of the Trump administration's efforts to remove references to diversity, equity, and inclusion from the federal government, the Air Force took down materials about the Tuskegee Airmen of World War II, the country's first black military pilots from federal websites. This particular erasure was quickly reversed. Last month, Arlington National Cemetery's website stopped prominently featuring the graves of renowned black, Hispanic, and female veterans, including members of the 6888. The web pages are still accessible via search, but they are no longer grouped into categories such as African American history and women's history. This timing is especially egregious when the country is just starting to appreciate the story of the 6888. North Carolina Representative Deborah Ross wrote in a letter to Defense Secretary Pete Hegseth earlier this month. When the 6888 was deployed in 1945, black organizations were pushing for the government to include black women in the Women's Army Corps, which already enabled white women to serve abroad. They kept hollering about wanting us to go overseas, so I guess they found something for us to do overseas. Take care of the mail, 104-year-old Fanny Griffin McClendon, one of the two surviving members of the unit, tells the Associated Press. And there was an awful lot of mail. The unit's members operated 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. In each of 3 daily 8-hour shifts, they processed 65,000 pieces of mail. After the war, they replicated their process in Rouen and Paris, France. They kept troops connected with their loved ones back home and made America a more perfect union, wrote Smithsonian's Jenny Rothberg Gritz in 2023. Eventually, the Congressional Gold Medal will hang in the Smithsonian for everyone to see, a mirror for our better selves and a beacon for all the brave girls still to come. That was the article, "The Only Black, All-Female Unit to Serve Overseas in World War II Receives the Congressional Gold Medal." This article was published by Smithsonian Magazine on April 30th, 2025, and written by Ellen Wexler. Next, I have another view of the United States military from the opinion pages of the Washington Post newspaper. The title is "Uncle Sam's New Message to Young Black Americans: I Don't Want You." This was written by Philip E. Thompson and published May 27, 2025. Philip E. Thompson, a former judge advocate in the Marine Corps, is a lawyer in Virginia. "I'm a proud Marine veteran with deep ties to military service. My wife served in the Air Force. My father fought in the Marines in World War II, and my grandfather served in the Army in World War I. I've spent much of my life surrounded by fellow veterans, bonded by sacrifice, stories, and a belief in the ideals the military represents. My car boasts a Marine Corps decal, and my sense of identity has been forever shaped by the uniform I once wore. But as I look at today's political environment, at President Donald Trump, his allies, and Defense Secretary Pete Hegseth, I'm forced to ask a question I never thought I'd have to pose. Should young black Americans serve in a military led by people who seem openly hostile to them and the legacy of those who came before them? My father and grandfather served in segregated units during the World Wars. They fought for democracy abroad while being denied it at home. When my grandfather returned to Mississippi from World War I, he was forced to flee the state by white supremacists who saw his service in France, as a black man in an unsegregated society, as a threat. My father returned from World War II only to be treated like a second-class citizen, denied certain veterans' benefits and rights under Jim Crow. When I served in the 1980s and 90s, racism still existed in the ranks. But many of us believed we could overcome it through dedication and excellence. We saw leaders such as General Colin Powell rise to the top. My wife earned senior enlisted status in the Air Force. I was quoted in a 1991 Newsweek article, "The Battle for Respect," about inequality in the military. Speaking that truth came at a cost to my career, but I stood by it then and still do now. Through it all, I remained proud of my service and the progress we were making. Under Presidents Ronald Reagan, George H.W. Bush, Bill Clinton, and George W. Bush, Black service members weren't always treated fairly, but we were not treated as enemies of the institution. Today it appears that's no longer the case. Under Trump and Hegseth, the environment for black service members is deteriorating. To my eyes, the campaign against wokeism is not about military readiness or discipline. It's a thinly veiled attack on diversity, equity, and inclusion, values that reflect both the reality of the American people and the strength of a united fighting force. Trump and his allies have pushed aggressively to defund or eliminate DEI programs across the military. One of Trump's first actions was to fire the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, General Charles Q. Brown, Jr., only the second African-American ever to hold that position. Training on racial bias, cultural competency, and inclusive leadership has been gutted and labeled radical. Officers who speak up about race or systemic injustice are accused of pushing politics, while those promoting exclusionary rhetoric are celebrated as patriots. The message is clear. If you're black, brown, or anything other than the old guard, a white male, your presence in the military is conditional and increasingly unwelcome. More disturbingly, the administration and its ideological allies are erasing the accomplishments of black service members from the nation's military narrative. Units such as the 369th Infantry Regiment, known as the Harlem Hellfighters, the Tuskegee Airmen, the Montfort Point Marines, and the Buffalo Soldiers are no longer central to the story the military tells about itself. The Pentagon has erased countless photos, videos, and articles about these units from its websites, although quickly restoring some, such as the Tuskegee Airmen, in response to an outcry. This isn't a side issue. It's a direct assault on truth and legacy. It's a denial of the sacrifices of generations of black Americans who fought and died for a country that did not always return the favor. Of course, Hegseth and his supporters argue that their opposition to DEI stems from a commitment to fairness and meritocracy. They assert that their aim is to benefit all service members, including black personnel, by eliminating what they perceive as divisive policies. But black service members have historically faced significant barriers to advancement, and these barriers still remain. As of 2023, black individuals constituted 19.5% of enlisted personnel, but only 9.2% of officers. Black officers are particularly underrepresented at the highest levels. Only 6.5% of generals are black. These discrepancies suggest systemic challenges that disproportionately affect promotion outcomes based on race. DEI initiatives were designed to complement, not replace, meritocracy. They aim to ensure that all service members are evaluated fairly and have equal access to opportunities, thereby strengthening the military as a whole. So I ask again, why should young black Americans serve under a government and military leadership that doesn't respect their presence, their contributions, or their history? Why should they risk their lives for a nation unwilling to defend them against racism or even acknowledge their service in its own historical record? My experience is that black Americans who serve are built different. We don't scare easily. We lead from the front. We serve because we believe in something larger than ourselves. Many of us would and have given our lives for this country. Service to your country for many black Americans is also seen as an entree into the middle class. Whether you only served one enlistment or made it a career, having military service on one's resume or job application was seen as a plus for African Americans, whose work ethic and experience were always seemingly in question. The military also provided training and job experience that, especially in the 1950s, 60s, and 70s, black Americans were not able to easily obtain in the civilian world. Service provided a twofold bargain for the country and the individual. But military service is a profound sacrifice. And when that sacrifice is met with hostility, erasure, or contempt from political leaders at the highest levels, we must pause and reassess. Is it still worth it? Right now, as I watch what is happening, my answer is sadly no. That was the opinion piece titled, Uncle Sam's New Message to Young Black Americans, I Don't Want You. It was written by Philip E. Thompson and published in the Washington Post newspaper on May 27, 2025. Next on today's African American Hour, an obituary. Charles Rangel, powerful voice for Harlem in Congress, dies at 94. This was written by Edward Walsh and published May 26, 2025, in the Washington Post's WashingtonPost.com website. Charles B. Rangel, a gravelly-voiced and exuberant congressman from the Harlem neighborhood of New York, who became the first African-American chairman of the House Ways and Means Committee, but was forced to relinquish that coveted position because of financial transgressions, died May 26th at a hospital in Manhattan. He was 94. His death was confirmed in a statement provided by the City College of New York, where he had served as statesman in residence. The cause was not immediately available. Mr. Rangel was an outspoken liberal Democrat during his 46-year congressional career, which ended in 2017 when he decided not to seek a 24th term in an increasingly Latino district that came to include Upper Manhattan and parts of the Bronx. His successor, Adriano Espaillat, became the first Dominican-American member of Congress. In the House, Mr. Rangel championed programs to aid the poor. He supported higher taxes on the wealthy, opposed interventionist military policies, including the 2003 invasion of Iraq, and worked against the 1996 welfare reform legislation that was signed into law by President Bill Clinton, a fellow Democrat. He could be caustic in public, but behind the scenes, the gregarious and genial Mr. Rangel, widely known as Charlie, was a popular figure on Capitol Hill, with friends in both parties. He was considered a shrewd and deft legislative craftsman, capable not only of compromise, but also of forging unlikely alliances with conservative Republicans. Mr. Rangel did so in his own style, always impeccably dressed, his voice rasping and almost a caricature of New Yorkese. The New York Daily News newspaper reported how Mr. Rangel calls the place where they show movies the theater. He cut a wide swath in Washington and beyond. In defining his influence, it helped that he represented Harlem, long considered the unofficial capital of Black America. He succeeded Adam Clayton Powell, Jr., in the House in 1971 and benefited from a strong political alliance with other Harlem power brokers that secured his home base. Early on, Mr. Rangel recognized that Ways and Means was at the crossroads of much legislation that would affect his and other poor congressional districts and set out to make the most of his clout. He sponsored legislation aimed at toppling the apartheid regime of South Africa and measures to spur economic development and construction of housing in low-income neighborhoods. More often than not, Mr. Rangel's handiwork could be found deep inside tax bills and other measures that passed through Ways and Means, in arcane provisions and numeric formulas that directly affected urban America in general, and New York and Harlem in particular. Charlie had used his position consistently to tweak every piece of legislation that went by him. Catherine Wilde, now president and chief executive of the Partnership for New York City, told the New Yorker magazine in 2000. He used it shamelessly, parochially, and for that we are very grateful. Congressional scholar Thomas E. Mann of the Brookings Institution said Mr. Rangel was known to be serious, informed, and capable of working with colleagues of diverse views on both sides of the aisle. His policy positions were generally in line with those of his constituents, and he looked out for their local interest as well. His ethical improprieties clouded what otherwise was a notable career in Congress. Mr. Rangel's downfall from the chairmanship of Ways and Means was all the more painful because he had come so far and waited so long to achieve a goal he set for himself in the 1970s. Abandoned by his father at 6, the high school dropout was a decorated combat veteran of the Korean War before attending college and law school and beginning a steady climb in politics. He became Ways and Means chairman after the 2006 elections, when Democrats regained control of the House, ending a decade during which he had battled as the panel's ranking Democrat while Republicans ran the show. As chairman of a committee with jurisdiction over health care legislation, Mr. Rangel was one of the key players in shaping the massive health care overhaul bill that President Obama signed in 2010. But even as he immersed himself in this and other legislative matters, his career was about to be upended. Beginning in 2008, newspaper disclosures about Mr. Rangel's personal finances led to an investigation by the House Ethics Committee. In February 2010, the panel admonished him for accepting corporate-sponsored trips to the Caribbean. A week later, under pressure from Democratic leaders who were growing increasingly nervous about the party's prospects in the 2010 midterm elections, Mr. Rangel stepped down temporarily as Ways and Means chairman. That did not end the investigation. In July 2010, the Ethics Committee issued a 40-page report detailing charges of 13 ethics violations. The allegations included that Mr. Rangel had used his office to solicit donations to the Charles B. Rangel Center for Public Service at the City College of New York from corporate executives who had business before his committee, failed to report and pay taxes on rental income from a villa he owned in the Dominican Republic, filed inaccurate financial disclosure statements that understated his assets by up to $500,000, and improperly used 4 rent-stabilized apartments provided by a Manhattan real estate developer. Throughout the investigation, Mr. Rangel maintained that he had never knowingly violated House rules or federal laws, and he was never charged with a civil or criminal violation. But amid an economic recession, it was clearly an embarrassment to have one of the leading tax officials in the nation found to be in violation of tax laws. On December 2, 2010, following a recommendation of the Ethics Committee, the House voted 333-79 to censure him for bringing discredit to the chamber, the most severe punishment short of expulsion. Standing in the well of the House after the vote, Mr. Rangel told his colleagues, "I know in my heart I am not going to be judged by this Congress. I'll be judged by my life in its entirety." Charles Bernard Rangel was born in Harlem on June 11, 1930. He was the second of 3 children born to Ralph Rangel, a laborer from Puerto Rico, and the former Blanche Mary Wharton, an African-American who worked as a seamstress in the garment district. The future congressman rarely spoke of his father, whom he described as physically abusive. In his 2007 memoir written by Leon Winter, titled, "And I Haven't Had a Bad Day Since," Mr. Rangel recalled seeing his father strike his mother on the steps of an apartment building. "I went and got a broom to hit my father," Mr. Rangel wrote. "He started laughing at me and then just walked away. I guess I've hated him ever since." After his father left the family, he was raised by his mother and her father, an elevator operator at the Criminal Courts Building in Manhattan. Mr. Rangel later said that it was his grandfather, Charles Wharton, who wore a slick uniform and seemed to know all the judges and lawyers who entered the building, who first inspired his interest in the law. But when he confided in Wharton that he wanted to be a lawyer, the grandfather's reaction was to laugh. Mr. Rangel dropped out of DeWitt Clinton High School after his sophomore year and, after holding several low-paying jobs, followed his older brother Ralph Jr. into the Army. President Harry S. Truman had ordered the military integrated in 1948, but the process was slow, and Rangel was assigned to an all-black artillery battalion. On a freezing November night in 1950, he was caught up in one of the great military reversals in U.S. history. The place was Kunuri, in the mountainous region of North Korea where U.S. troops had driven to within striking distance of the Yalu River at the Chinese border. catching the Americans unprepared, massive waves of Chinese soldiers crossed the river from the north, driving the Americans back and all but encircling Mr. Rangel's unit. Mr. Rangel led more than 40 men on foot around the Kunu Ri Pass to safety on the other side of the mountain. He was wounded by shrapnel during the fighting and was awarded the Bronze Star and the Purple Heart. He credited the Army with turning his life around. Back in New York, he earned his high school diploma in 1 year and a bachelor's degree from New York University School of Commerce. With the help of a full scholarship, he obtained a law degree in 1960 from St. John's University in Brooklyn, now in Queens. In 1964, he married Alma Carter. She died in 2024. Survivors include two children, Stephen Rangel and Alicia Halton, and three grandsons. After a short stint in private practice, he became in 1961 an assistant U.S. attorney in the Southern District of New York. During that time, he made lasting friendships with three men who would be his political allies: Percy Sutton, who became Manhattan Borough President; Basil A. Patterson, New York's first black Secretary of State and father of the state's first black governor; and David Dinkins, New York's first black mayor. Collectively, we were known as the Gang of Four and exerted immense political influence in Harlem and beyond. When Sutton was elected Manhattan Borough President, Mr. Rangel was elected in 1966 to fill Sutton's old seat in the New York State Assembly. He remained in Albany for two terms and emerged as a leader among the state's black legislators. Among the political friends Mr. Rangel made in Albany was New York's liberal Republican governor, Nelson A. Rockefeller. Mr. Rangel's profile began to rise. He was viewed as a potential successor to Representative Powell, who had been the first person to claim the title of Congressman from Harlem after the New York legislature created the district in the 1940s to satisfy demands that Harlem's black citizens have their own congressional representative. Powell was a charismatic preacher whose flamboyant personality and lifestyle eventually devolved into self-destructiveness. With the seniority he had earned, Powell was instrumental in helping President Lyndon B. Johnson push through his Great Society legislation in the mid-1960s. But by the end of the decade, Powell was living in virtual exile. Expelled by Congress in 1967 and reinstated by a U.S. Supreme Court decision, suffering from cancer, he spent most of his time on the island of Bimini in the Bahamas. In late 1969, Rockefeller dispatched Mr. Rangel to Bimini to try to coax the congressman to come home. Mr. Rangel warned Powell of political maneuverings against him at home, but Powell dismissed the threats. Then Mr. Rangel said he might run against Powell himself. "Do what you have to do, baby," Powell replied, patting Mr. Rangel on the cheek. In the ensuing Democratic primary, Mr. Rangel had only good things to say about Powell's past contributions to Harlem, but was critical of his absenteeism and recent lack of attention to the district. He defeated Powell by a plurality of 150 votes in the five-candidate field. In Washington, Mr. Rangel was a founding member of the Congressional Black Caucus and was elected its chairman in 1974. He first gained national attention as a junior member of the House Judiciary Committee for his informed questioning of witnesses during the impeachment hearings of President Richard M. Nixon. On the Judiciary panel, Mr. Rangel concentrated on stemming the flow of illegal drugs into the country, a major concern in his district, but his eyes were already on ways and means. With jurisdiction over taxes, trade policy, Social Security, Medicare, and other major government programs, it was the Money Committee, he once said, that would give him leverage on various issues. When you represent a poor community and you're looking in the long range, you have to be in a bargaining position with those who have an entirely different agenda, Mr. Rangel told the New Yorker in 2000. There's not a tax bill that poor and working people don't come out ahead on because of my efforts. He switched to Ways and Means in 1975 and became its first black member. When he took over as chairman 32 years later, he became the highest-ranking and most powerful African-American lawmaker in U.S. history. With the sponsorship of Majority Whip and future Speaker Thomas Tip O'Neill Jr. of Massachusetts, he also rose steadily in the House leadership. He had a close, if sometimes tempestuous, relationship with Ways and Means Chairman Dan Rostenkowski, Democrat of Illinois, another product of big city Democratic politics, who appreciated Mr. Rangel's loyalty and skill at forging consensus. Charlie has the gifted knack of getting you to change your position, and you actually enjoy doing it, Rostenkowski told the New York Times in 1986, as the two men worked with a Republican White House on the landmark Tax Reform Act of 1986 that included low-income housing tax credits that Mr. Rangel had pushed. In 1987, Congress reenacted the Rangel Amendment, named after its author, which denied tax credits to U.S. companies doing business in apartheid-era South Africa. A leading liberal on most issues, he broke with many of his Democratic colleagues in supporting free trade agreements. Mr. Rangel also teamed up with Representative Jack Kemp, Republican of New York, to win passage of legislation creating federal empowerment zones that provided tax and other incentives for businesses to operate in inner-city neighborhoods. One of the first, the Upper Manhattan Empowerment Zone, was in Harlem and regarded as a catalyst for what came to be known as the Second Harlem Renaissance. Mr. Rangel, a staunch supporter of Hillary Clinton when she ran for the Senate in New York and sought the 2008 Democratic presidential nomination, also was instrumental in persuading her husband, Bill Clinton, to locate his post-presidential office in Harlem. That was the obituary titled, Charles Rangel, Powerful Voice for Harlem in Congress, Dies at 94. It was written by Edward Walsh and published May 26, 2025 in the Washington Post's WashingtonPost.com website. Next on today's African American Hour is a reading that originates in Texas. The title is The Shape of Freedom. This was written by Jacoba Urist and published in the June 2025 edition of Smithsonian Magazine. The subtitle to the story is, In 1869, three formerly enslaved artisans started a stoneware business in Central Texas. A century and a half later, they've put their stamp on the world. In 1856, the Reverend John McCamey Wilson, Jr., a Presbyterian minister and entrepreneur interested in clay science, relocated from North Carolina to Texas. There in the Capote Hills, a rural, sparse enclave in Guadalupe County, 12 miles from the town of Seguin, Wilson opened a business called Guadalupe Pottery. Wilson mainly sold jugs, churns, crocks, and cemetery flower jars. The pots featured crescent handles and a deep, chocolate-colored interior of liquefied clay. Before refrigerators and iceboxes, high-fire, non-porous pottery was essential to life, the Tupperware or Ziploc bags of the 19th century. Clay pots preserved everything from grains, beef, and butter, to whiskey and even drinking water. The potters who worked under Wilson's direction mostly used alkaline glaze, one of the oldest methods in ceramics to create a glassy exterior from a slurry of wood ash, sand, and clay, an arduous process in the 1850s. It took days to stoke underground wood-burning kilns to a high enough temperature for a successful firing. Three of Wilson's potters were enslaved servants who traveled to Texas with him: Hiram, James, and Wallace. For more than a decade, these men were responsible for nearly every facet of Guadalupe Pottery's production, from mixing clay and expertly throwing the pots on a kick wheel, to glazing and stacking vessels and meticulously controlling the temperature and duration of the kiln's flames. The men kept working for the Reverend even after Abraham Lincoln issued the Emancipation Proclamation on January 1, 1863. In Texas, slavery didn't end until June 19, 1865, when Major General Gordon Granger arrived in Galveston and issued General Order No. 3, informing the people of Texas that all who'd been enslaved were free, the event commemorated as Juneteenth. In 1869, Hiram founded his own stoneware business at a new site with James and Wallace, H. Wilson and Company. Though not biologically related, all three took their enslaver's surname, the practice of some black Americans at the time. Some scholars believe that H. Wilson and Company was the first business in Texas founded and owned by formerly enslaved people. A century and a half later, the pots they made are celebrated in the ceramics world. In silvery grays and greens, with uneven salt drips and textured glazes that resemble the moon's surface, or sometimes an orange peel, Wilson wares are coveted both as objects of art and for their extraordinary story of black self-determination in the post-war South. Wilson pottery now resides in museums across the United States, from the Smithsonian's National Museum of American History to the Museum of Fine Arts in Houston, an indelible part of the country's entrepreneurial and creative heritage. The story of Hiram, James, and Wallace Wilson is woven through with threads of folklore, given the sparse records kept at the time, particularly for people born into slavery. But over the last 50 years, researchers have uncovered more details about the Wilsons. Georgiana Greer, a San Antonio pediatrician and ceramics collector aficionado, was passionate about locating abandoned kilns, and she left a trove of Wilson information behind, including a 1973 taped interview with James Wilson's son, James Wilson Jr. Emancipation offered the Wilsons an opportunity none had ever expected. Establishing a pottery business was complex and costly. It meant finding a suitable site, testing clay, constructing a kiln, and hiring proficient workers. "And the men did all this in an intensely dangerous environment," said Ashley Williams, a recent fellow at the Smithsonian American Art Museum. In the late 1860s, black residents of Guadalupe County filed almost 200 complaints with the Freedmen's Bureau for unpaid wages and violent crimes perpetrated against them. A Baptist missionary from Maine, the Reverend Leonard Ilsley, helped Hiram buy 600 acres of land for $500 and likely either gave Hiram a personal loan or served as a guarantor of the transaction. When Hiram died in 1884, survived by his wife, Cynthia, and 11 children, Ilsley served as administrator of his estate. One of Hiram's great-great-granddaughters, Laverne Lewis Britt, first discovered her connection to the Potters after her retirement, when she became interested in genealogy. Over the course of 5 years, she researched and wrote a book called In Praise of Hiram Wilson, which describes how her ancestor created a thriving post-slavery community in Capote. Hiram set aside 10 of his 600 acres for a Baptist church and became its minister. The white steepled chapel remains active today, beside a cemetery with cedar and crepe myrtle trees. Many Wilsons have been laid to rest there, including Hiram, whose grave is marked by a tall obelisk. Hiram also founded a one-room schoolhouse where Paula King Harper, another of his descendants, says her grandmother once taught. King Harper is the current president of the Wilson Pottery Foundation. On the phone, she described how interest in her celebrated ancestor's technique has spread in collector circles since the organization's founding in 1999. A pottery collector in San Antonio was at a garage sale and noticed the green salt glaze drip from underneath dirt that had dried on a gallon jug. They purchased it for less than $10, went home, cleaned it up, and guess what it was? A stamp H. Wilson. Finding that stamp is now the equivalent of finding a signed painting by a renowned artist. King Harper once sat at an auction that included several pieces of Wilson pottery from someone's private estate. "There was a beautiful, pristine 5-gallon jug I watched sell for $12,000, she said. Traditionally, clay artists who made quotidian jugs and jars rather than purely aesthetic works have been considered second-tier makers, ranking below sculptors. But over the last few decades, contemporary and historic ceramicists like the Wilsons are receiving new scholarly and art world attention. Williams, the recent Smithsonian Fellow, is researching the Wilsons as part of her doctorate at Columbia University. She notes that most enslaved potters wouldn't have been able to inscribe their names or initials on a pot. But once the Wilson potters were free, they added a maker's mark, which made all the difference. Future generations were able to dive into the records and find out more about the remarkable potters. Because we can tie the makers to these objects, which is so rare, it allows us to see the story about the resilience of the Wilson potters during slavery and their extreme success and survival, Williams said. The Wilson style may have been influenced by the works coming out of the Edgefield District in South Carolina, a place then known as a kind of pottery mecca. It was famous for massive bulbous jars and glazes, features that the early Wilson pots share. Edgefield has its own significant history of highly skilled black craftsmen, including David Drake, the earliest known enslaved potter to inscribe his work. Later, the Wilson's pottery took on more distinctive features. The men started out using alkaline glaze, but once they opened their own business, they switched to salt glaze, likely for its strength and waterproofing properties. Salt glazes also produces more consistent colors and textures, such as the bumpy orange peel finish admired by H. Wilson and Company collectors. At the time, the method was uncommon in Texas, according to Michelle Johnson, project manager of the William J. Hill Texas Artisans and Artists Archive at the Bayou Bend Collection and Gardens, part of the Museum of Fine Arts of Houston. And it was dangerous, she said, because salt glaze produces highly toxic chlorine gas from the wet salt thrown into the kiln during firing. For this reason, contemporary ceramicists avoid the method altogether. The Wilsons may have learned the technique from Isaac Suttles, an Ohio-born potter known for salt glazing, who is listed in the United States Census as living in Seguin at the time. Lid rims are another notable element of H. Wilson & Company's jars. At the first pottery-making site, during their enslavement, the men made more tie-down rims, jars without lids that require paper or cloth as a cover, which were easier and faster to make. Later, at their own shop, they crafted rims fitted for lids. These lid rims allowed for more watertight storage, but they also required more sophisticated expertise. If you think you may have stumbled on one of these treasures at a garage or estate sale, look for a horseshoe-like handle, the most significant visual identifier of a Wilson pot. It's still unclear why Hiram James and Wallace switched to these thicker rolled handles from their original Edgefield-inspired crescents. It may have been because horseshoe handles are sturdier, offering more surface connection to the pot's body. It's another puzzling question that Williams is pursuing and hopes to answer in the future. It took a long time for the art world to discover the Wilsons' creations. After Hiram's death in 1884, James and Wallace Wilson went on to work at another pottery site run by Marion Durham, a potter from South Carolina who had moved to Texas with John Chandler, who was most likely his enslaved servant at the time. By the time the Wilsons joined them, Durham and Chandler were in business together. That site closed in 1903. These pots remained in circulation, but many details of their story were lost. Decades later, an anthropology graduate student named Elmer Joe Brackner Jr. conducted a magnetometry survey to find buried pottery. Clay contains iron oxides that can become magnetized. At the original Guadalupe pottery site, he found what's known as a groundhog kiln, a uniquely southern, semi-subterranean kiln used in the 19th century for firing alkaline glazed pottery. At the second site, home of the independent H. Wilson & Company, Brackner found ceramic glazed shards and another groundhog kiln. His research and that of Georgiana Greer, the ceramic historian, helped piece together the Wilsons' unusual story. After many years of advocacy by the Wilson Pottery Foundation, art historians and curators began scouring land deeds, court documents, and handwritten capacity marks, numbers that denote the volume of each jug, to present a fuller picture of the Wilsons, sometimes correcting previous theories about their methodology and timeline. Texas ceramic artist Earlene Greer researches the Wilsons' past by creating her own pottery to honor their legacy. In 2018, she interviewed Wilson descendants and collectors and visited historical societies in Texas for archival information. 2 years later, she curated an exhibition on her campus in Fort Worth. The show also displays ceramic pieces she created based on the work of the Wilson potters. The narrative continues to evolve, due in no small part to proud descendants of Hiram, James, and Wallace. Every 3 years, hundreds of people gather in Seguin, Texas, for a jubilant 3-day Wilson family reunion that is open to the public. That was the article, The Shape of Freedom. In 1869, three formerly enslaved artisans started a stoneware business in Central Texas. A century and a half later, they've put their stamp on the art world. This was written by Jacoba Urist and published in the June 2025 edition of Smithsonian Magazine. My next reading is about the Smithsonian Museum. The title is National African American Museum Faces Uncertainty Without Its Leader. This was published in the New York Times newspaper on May 9, 2025, and written by Graham Boley and Jennifer Scheiser. The subtitle to the story is, At a time when it is under scrutiny from the White House, the Smithsonian's National Museum of African American History and Culture is without its director, who stepped down last month. In the 8 years since it opened on the National Mall, the National Museum of African American History and Culture has become one of the glittering jewels of the Smithsonian Institution. With award-winning architecture, a three-tiered shape evoking a traditional Yoruban crown, and installations portraying the struggles and triumphs of African Americans, the museum registered its 10 millionth visitor in 2023 and is one of the Smithsonian's most popular museums. But now it is in the crosshairs of President Trump, who issued an executive order in March that seeks to address what he described as the Smithsonian's promotion of narratives that portray American and Western values as inherently harmful and oppressive, singling out the African American Museum as a particular offender. The president's order has left the museum trying to navigate its most challenging political environment in a moment when it finds itself without a permanent leader. Its director, Kevin Young, was on leave when the order was issued and left soon afterward. Some see the museum as threatened. Several hundred protesters marched to the museum on Saturday, demanding that black history and the museums that explore it be protected from interference. Some of the protesters brandished homemade signs, like one with the museum's initials, I Love NMAAHC, while others wore badges that said, I Take My History Black. So much of black history was lost and was recaptured, said Beatrice Turpin Peake, 59 from Maryland, who joined the march. To hear that it's under attack, it's just heartbreaking. Mr. Young, 54, a highly regarded poet and essayist who took the job in 2021, told the museum staff that he was leaving after 4 years to focus on writing. But the timing surrounding his resignation fueled questions. People familiar with the circumstances said in recent interviews that Mr. Young's departure was negotiated after some Smithsonian officials began to question whether he was a good fit for the job. Directing the African American Museum, which has some 230 employees and welcomes more than 1 million visitors each year, was more complex than Mr. Young's former role leading the Schoenberg Center for Research in Black Culture, a division of the New York Public Library, which has 80 employees and is focused mainly on research. He also took on the Washington job while juggling his writing career. He has written or edited 4 books since 2021, and continuing as poetry editor of The New Yorker, a position he has held since 2017. Mr. Young declined to be interviewed, but in an email announcing his departure to staff last month, he cited several achievements during his tenure, including opening 7 major exhibitions and completing a $350 million fundraising campaign. He described leading the museum as a role I have fully embraced. I am looking forward to the next phase of life, he continued, including returning to writing full-time after 2 decades in museums and libraries, and am happy to say I do so with the encouragement of my family and friends. While at the Schomburg, Mr. Young, a graduate of Harvard and Brown, and a former curator and professor of literature at Emory University, presided over major acquisitions including the archives of Harry Belafonte, Ossie Davis and Ruby Dee, and the rap impresario Fab Five Freddy. Lonnie G. Bunch III, the African American Museum's founding director and now the secretary of the Smithsonian Institution, in describing his rationale for selecting Mr. Young to succeed him in 2020, spoke of Mr. Young's passion for making black history accessible. The Smithsonian's tax filing for the year that ended in September 2022, the most recent available, lists the value of Mr. Young's salary and benefits package at $456,275. In March, before the president's executive order, Mr. Young went on an indefinite personal leave. He announced his permanent departure in the email to staff 3 weeks later. Shanita Brackett, the museum's associate director of operations, who was highly regarded by many in museum management circles, was appointed interim director. She has worked at the museum since 2016 and once served as the acting director of the Smithsonian's Anacostia Community Museum. Museum officials did not respond to requests to interview Ms. Brackett, in keeping with what has been the Smithsonian's efforts to keep a low profile in the wake of Mr. Trump's order. Several members of the African American Museum Board declined to comment or did not respond to queries. Vedette Coleman Robinson, the chief executive of the Association of African American Museums, which sponsored the rally, said that she did not think the departure of Mr. Young had left the museum in a particularly vulnerable position. The work still gets done, she said. The mission still gets done as long as that team is there doing really good work. They will be fine. The stark ambitions and abrupt pursuit of Mr. Trump's agenda in his second term as president underlie much of the concern that spurred Saturday's march as a show of support for the museum. Our opponents are trying to erase black history, black voices, and black lives, said Kimberly Williams Crenshaw, a law professor and executive director of the African American Policy Forum, who was helping to lead the effort to protect the museum. Though the African American Museum celebrates the achievements of black Americans, some worry that its exploration of the horrors of slavery and discrimination make it vulnerable to a White House whose executive order suggests that the Smithsonian has come under the influence of a divisive race-centered ideology. Michael M. Kaiser, chairman of the DeVos Institute of Arts Management and former president of the Kennedy Center in Washington, cited such a concern in a recent interview. It's a whole museum on a topic that the president doesn't seem to want dealt with by the Smithsonian, he said. The only specific mention of the African American Museum in the Trump executive order criticized a graphic about whiteness and white culture posted on its website in May 2020 before Mr. Young's arrival at the museum. The graphic referred to the Protestant work ethic, rugged individualism, and the nuclear family as aspects of white culture that people of color had internalized. The graphic, part of the museum's new Talking About Race portal, was criticized by Donald Trump Jr. and other conservatives and was removed 6 weeks after its posting. Since late January, when President Trump issued an executive order banning diversity, equity, and inclusion efforts in the federal government, much of the rest of the material in the portal, now called Teaching and Learning, has also been removed. Asked about the change, the museum said in a statement that it was integrating the portal content elsewhere on its website as part of our ongoing efforts to enhance the digital experience. There is no evidence that recent programming at the museum played any role in the concerns raised by the White House. Under Mr. Young, the museum opened culturally focused temporary exhibitions including ones on Afrofuturism and black design. Last December, it opened In Slavery's Wake, a major exhibition about the legacy of the global slave trade that will travel to museums in Europe, Africa, and South America. The exhibition Afrofuturism, A History of Black Futures, was in keeping with the erudite remix sensibility of Mr. Young's writing as it hopscotched across genres and periods. The show combined artifacts like an original T'Challa costume from the movie Black Panther, a flight suit worn by Trayvon Martin at an aviation camp, and material relating to the enslaved poet Phyllis Wheatley, who in 1774 became the first American of African descent to publish a book. Miss Coleman Robinson said that exhibition was a particular achievement of Mr. Young's. He did some really good work with his team, she said. One current exhibition, Reckoning, Protest, Defiance, Resilience, which opened in 2021, focuses on the relationship between art and black protest, including the Black Lives Matter movement. Mr. Trump has called that phrase a symbol of hate. In the wake of the executive order, inaccurate reports surfaced. A portion of the Woolworth's lunch counter was said to have been removed from the African American Museum. Portions of the lunch counter are in the National Museum of American History and the African American Museum and have not been removed. A minister and civil rights activist from San Francisco also suggested that two artifacts he had lent to the African American Museum had been returned prematurely. The Smithsonian said the objects were being returned simply because of the routine expiration of the loan agreement. That was the article, National African American Museum Faces Uncertainty Without Its Leader. This was published in the New York Times newspaper on May 9, 2025, and was written by Graham Boley, Robin Polgrabin, and Jennifer Scheiser. That's all the time we have this week. If you would like to listen to this program again or past editions of the African American Hour, you can find them wherever you get your podcasts or at the Audio Reader website at reader.ku.edu. I'm Byron Buckner, and thank you for listening to the African American Hour.